experience. Good to have you back. I think the last time you were here, we chatted on the occasion of Huckleberry Finn.
Right. That's right. Beautiful. About 1985. Was it? 85, 86, somewhere like
that. Was a long time ago. Yeah. Is that a University of...
University of California, that one. Yeah.
And you did a number of books since that time. Tell me about what happened in between the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Huckleberry Finn.
Well, I guess the biggest thing that happened in between was my first children's book. And that was... book called Jump, retellings, or not retellings, but adaptations of some of the Brer Rabbit stories by Van Dyke Parks, who's something of a, has some notoriety in the musical world as a musician and a film score and so forth. Anyway, that was probably the biggest thing, because that was like opening up the floodgates. And God knows they've come fast and furious since then, because there were three of those in a series, and then a whole bunch of other books with Virginia Hamilton and Nancy Willard, and I think probably 12 children's books, something like that.
Are you continuing to do these beautiful limited edition books?
Not really. This one is in limbo as to whether it's going to actually make an appearance as a limited edition book or not. And that basically has to do with the fact that I no longer have my shop. So it's not... The physical setup is not the same as it was 10 years ago.
You had a kind of a converted farm, didn't you?
Yeah, and it was a actually it was a stable, a horse stable that was converted into a printing shop. Well, first it was converted into a garage, and then we converted it into a printing shop. But then I gave up that shop last year, because mainly because the books that I'm doing now are for the trade, and I've gotten so far into that, and it's an interesting thing to me, too, because what happens, there are not many people who have gone from, first of all, I was trained as a painter, from going from the fine arts from painting into printmaking, from printmaking into bookmaking, from fine bookmaking into the trade world. So I'm bringing into making trade books this long tradition of the book as a fine art form. And there are only two or three people who have done that. David Godin is probably the biggest example of that. So I'm real excited about that, and my excitement for doing limited edition books has waned considerably in the last 5 or 6 years. It's just the frightful problems, you know, just the, that is entirely my responsibility. I'm not only the designer and the illustrator, but I'm also the editor, and I am production manager, and I have to foster this thing from day one to...
Well, there may be a distribution problem as well, but as
enormous, yeah.
Most of your earlier books were subscribed to and all but sold out before they were printed.
Only one. I wish I could say, oh, you're so right. But oh no, only Alice was completely subscribed and is sold out. All the other books I still have in print. And which is another issue, you know, the whole financial issue.
But they can still be ordered from you.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Give me a list of some of those limited editions and how they can be obtained.
Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There, The Wizard of Oz, Huckleberry Finn, and Frankenstein are still available. And plus others that are much smaller. These are big books. These are 14 by 17 inch formats, and these are very large books. All the illustrations are printed from the original wood blocks, you know, that sort of thing. All letterpress printing, hand typography, and papers that were specially made for my press and that sort of thing. So they're books done in the really fine way, books as objects of art.
You better give us a rough idea about how much they are.
$1,000 to $1,500.
That's nothing.
Yeah, yeah, basically. When you consider that you have over 100, well, maybe not over 100, but from 50 to 100 original prints, you break that down, if you've got 100 prints and you have $1,500, it's $15 a print. And my prints sell in galleries for, you know, anywhere from $75 to $700 a piece. So it's a bargain. Sure, they're handmade books. Yeah. There are only 300 copies of them that we make. And then we've taken those books and sold the rights to a trade publisher. And we've done that with the University of California, University of Nebraska, and Harcourt Brace Yovanovitch in the past.
You're still living in the same place?
Still, well, I'm living in the same neighborhood.
You moved out of
the old farmhouse and built a built myself a nice big place up in the woods.
How's the studio set up?
Studio is a third of the house, and it's not physically separated from the house. It's just that end of the house, which is two stories high, and has a catwalk around part of it, which is a library annex, as it were, up there, and a 24-foot high area in one section, just in case one of these days I want to do some big paintings or go into motor vehicle work of some sort, you know, become a mechanic in my old age.
Auto repairs,
yeah, that sort of thing, exactly.
What happened to the press?
I sold it to Alan Robinson, who is another book artist who lives in the area. We're very rich in my part of Western Massachusetts in the book arts, and in every aspect of the book arts. I mean, from people who write the books to people who produce the books, it's really quite amazing.
Well, that takes us up to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This
right.
is a book that I assumed I had read.
Most people have.
Everybody assumes right. he or she has read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I discovered that I had not read the
right.
book as a kid. Recently, I did read Valerie Martin's Mary Riley,
right.
which I believe is actually a larger book.
Much larger.
Than the original.
Oh, much larger, yeah.
Tell me about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. First, tell me how you became interested in it so that you did the whiplash for it.
Well, it came out directly out of Frankenstein. When I did my edition of Frankenstein, I had four scholars do pieces for me. See, the original Frankenstein was, I'm not going to get off onto Frankenstein here too far. The original Frankenstein was in three volumes, so I wanted, and it was in blue paper, so what I wanted to do was print the book on white paper, but have blue sections interspersed between those three volumes. And so I had, which is four places, so I had four scholars write pieces for me. Joyce Carol Oates was one of those four people who did that, and when California picked up the book, they only used her essay. They didn't use the other three. And so after California's book was out, if their version of my Frankenstein was out, I was in Princeton having dinner with Joyce and her husband, Ray Smith. And Joyce asked me, what's in the works? What else you got, you know, cooking? And I said, well, I'd really like to do a trilogy of horror stories. I'd like to do follow Frankenstein up with Jekyll and Hyde and Dracula. And she sat back and looked at me and she said, you know, it's funny you would say that because along with Dorian Gray, those are the four titles that I teach in my course at Princeton. And I said, well, you interested in doing it? And she said, sure. 10 days later, I had the introduction to Jekyll and Hyde. And so I designed it and presented it to, presented it around, and finally University of Nebraska picked it up.
How familiar were you with the story?
Like everyone else, familiar with it only through film versions. And though I had read the book 5 or 6 years ago, so I mean, it's not that I just read it this year, but like it's, you know, and same thing what you said a minute ago, same thing with Huckleberry Finn. Everybody thinks they've read Huckleberry Finn, but very few people actually have because they confuse Tom Sawyer with it. You know, everybody thinks they've read Tom Sawyer, they think they've read Huckleberry Finn, which is not the case.
And everybody thinks he's read Frankenstein.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Dracula.
And The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's sure.
And some of actually, I had read The Wizard of Oz and Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn as a kid, but some of these others, for some reason, they were so familiar, but they
right.
just escaped me.
Right. And the film versions have not done a whole lot to to help the thing a lot, is because they're so bastardized, the film versions. I mean, they change things around so much.
Yeah, especially those films in the 30s and 40s where they took so many liberties in order to appeal to a vast section of...
Yeah. Well, even so now, I mean, I saw the one that was done on television, the Jekyll and Hyde that was done this spring, and it too fell into the same kind of liberties. Especially with the liberty of taking, bringing up a woman in the story, giving Henry Jekyll a love interest, which of course is not in the book at all.
No, there's no women. There are no women in the story except for Mary Riley being made.
Well, she's not even in the story. Valerie Martin made her up completely. In fact, Valerie's another one of the people that lives in my area. I mean, she lives in Amherst, and we were talking about this a couple of months ago, and the maid that's mentioned in the story is not the maid she had in mind.
The maid has no name.
The maid in the story has no name whatsoever, but that's not actually the maid that she had in mind. She had an entirely fictional, you know, person. But this hers is a quite a wonderful book, and the two things read together very well.
And most people, of course, picture Mr. Hyde as a monster, but
right.
actually in the original version, he's a very small...
He's a dwarf, absolutely. And that's another one of the things that filmmakers have missed the boat on, is they've always, and even the great, I mean the great actors, Spencer Tracy, Frederick March, John Barrymore, you know, they have used the same actor to play both roles. Seems to me that's never been, it's not really a good idea, because the two people are two people. I mean, those are two distinctly different characters, both in physical stature and in emotional stature. So it seems only reasonable to use two people. Because, you know, one of the ones that looms the largest in my mind is Jack Palance's version, which was made for television, I don't know how long ago, 20 years ago probably. It's real hard for a big man to become small. So there's not that diminutive figure of Hyde, and that to me is psychologically as well as visually a major point that's missed.
And yet Hyde is Jekyll's evil side.
Yes, and absolutely. But they are distinctly two personalities. And this is another thing that I try to point out in the illustrations of the book, if indeed illustrations can be that narrative, is that Hyde is not so much Jekyll's twin brother, his parasitic twin, as has been so often pointed out, but he's his son. Henry Jekyll, and I think I will quote him verbatim, Henry Jekyll says at one point in his confession, the last chapter of the book, he says, "I had more than a father's interest in Hyde, yet Hyde had more of a son's indifference to me." So he says out of his own words that he, it's a father-son relationship.
And indeed Hyde is much younger.
Much younger, yeah, much younger. Much more virile.
Tell me about the illustrations and how you conceived of these.
Well, they all came from that line. When I was reading the book, probably for the fourth or fifth time, I was struck by that particular phrase because it resounded in my mind, or echoed in my mind, a few things from Frankenstein and from other literary sources. When the absence of the woman, the absence of a mother figure, is real important, because this brings up almost an Adamic kind of situation where Adam is born without a mother. It also is true with Frankenstein. Frankenstein's monster was born without a mother. Edward Hyde is born without a mother. The fact that the tincture which Henry Jekyll imbibes is drunk from glass, which I don't think is an accident, rather than, say, a ceramic cup, a crucible or anything like that. It takes a vial, it's glass, and it's filled with a smoking, I'm quoting again, smoking blood-colored, unquote, tincture. So Edward Hyde is, in fact, born in vitro from Henry Jekyll. Now, I see this in my fourth or fifth reading, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, now what I should do then is to take all of my images directly from Henry Jekyll's confession, which is the last chapter of the book. So all of those images have to come right out of Jekyll's own words. They're not Landon's words, they're not Utterson's words, they're all Jekyll's words. Because I thought taking his confession was a more reliable, a more direct avenue to the central characters. So that began it. And that's why you see the first image is a portrait of Henry Jekyll's father, which is actually based on a portrait of Robert Louis Stevenson's father, an extant portrait of Stevenson's father. The last image in the book, which is on the cover of the book, is the same portrait of Jekyll's father ripped asunder, torn to pieces by our friend Edward Hyde. Why does he tear up Jekyll's father's portrait at the end? Why does he destroy the image of his father? So there's this father-son relationship that keeps going. So that's the main theme, as far as I'm concerned. The second theme is the theme of hands. Because in his confession, he talks about seeing for the first time, when he's made this transmogrification, he sees for the first time this hand lying out on the bedclothes. He sees it bathed in yellow light, which is interesting because Victor Frankenstein's monster is yellow, though he's 8 feet tall. He sees this hand bathed in yellow light laying out on the bedclothes with a dusky color and knuckly and corded and covered in a swart of black hair. That's the first knowledge that he has, first visual knowledge he has of Edward Hyde. And then another point he compares, he talks about his own hand being white and comely and soft and gentle, that sort of thing. So he makes a comparison between these two hands. And then in between those two hand images comes this whole play on the hand and handwriting, because Jekyll's presented with a problem. Hyde has to have access to money. He has to be able to pay his own bills for his apartment and for his new clothes, because Jekyll's clothes don't fit him any too well. So he opens up a checking account, and he finds that if I only slanted my handwriting, my own hand, backwards, it disguised enough to be passable. Well, the interesting thing is that if you write, and we can assume that Henry Jekyll, being a 19th century British physician, wrote an italic hand, because that's what people wrote, the educated classes in England wrote in the 19th century. If he were to slant the word Hyde, in calligraphy we talk about the cant being the slope of the letter. So if we slope the cant backwards from the vertical, that is to the left, as he would by making his handwriting backwards, and you make the two strokes of the H, you parallel in the mirror image the two final strokes of Jekyll, which are the two L's. So, and then you go to the Y, which is the next letter. And then you go to a K in Jekyll, and you go to a D in Hyde, and then you get the H. So it is, in a sense, and this is purely my observation. I have no academic or scholarly apparatus backing this up at all. It is strictly a visual observation. So you get this hand in the terms of handwriting, which becomes real important, too. And that plays in on mirrors. He makes an awful lot about mirrors. He talks about Edward Hyde being nothing more than a breath on a mirror and that sort of thing.
Well, it's obvious that you've done more than illustrate this book. You've thought about the book and tried to get into it, as opposed to the illustrators in these late 19th century books, early 20th century books, when books were illustrated then. But they always showed action scenes.
Right, which I avoid.
Yeah, they didn't get into the heart of the book.
Right,
so
right.
Sometimes I notice in some of these older books that they were usually in plates, and they would be in a different location.
Right.
And I'd get to that plate, and I'd try to figure out exactly. It didn't match the text.
Right, exactly. And that bothers me intensely, and I refuse to do it. When I do illustrate a book, and I'm doing a collection of Poe stories now, which is done that way. The book is printed, black, and then the illustrations are printed separately on a different stock in full color, and then those are tipped on top of the signatures. Well, I refuse to let something be known visually before the author lets it be known. And so it causes me an awful lot of problems going back, rereading that text and rereading the text to find what image I can use at that point, and drives art directors crazy because they want to know, well, what are the images going to be? I say, I haven't the foggiest idea until I have the book in dummy. You know, when I've got it pasted up and I know exactly where that book is going, what the rotation of the pages is and all that, I won't know what the images are. So, but you're absolutely right. I do try to think about a book, and I do read as much as I can scholarly material on the book. Sometimes that's a big help. Sometimes it's not a big help. Sometimes it's no help at all. I'm teaching a course next year at Rhode Island School of Design, and the first lesson, as it were, the first meeting, is how to read. Because most illustrators don't read. I don't think. I mean, they read it, and they read a book, and then they give you, they go through rehashing things that writers have already done, which to me is redundant and unnecessary. If I can't make a contribution to a book, I don't want to do the book. I don't want to merely rehash something that Mark Twain's done. Then you stand in the shadow of somebody like Mark Twain or Robert Louis Stevenson, and they can do the action scene so much better than I can do the action scene that I'd rather not do that. So therefore, my images almost down the line are always solitary figures. Sometimes there'll be two or three figures. Occasionally there'll be a figure in landscape, that sort of thing. But I very seldom ever show images of figures interacting with each other because the writer's done that. I don't feel it's my place to interfere with that. And if I do a bad job of it, then I do disservice to my text. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, the single unforgivable sin of an illustrator.
And, of course, your effort also is to capture the mood. For example, the Victorian images I have are dark and sinister.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What is a woodcut? I mean, actually, how do you physically do this?
Well, it's a relief printmaking technique, that is to separate it from lithography or from intaglio techniques. It is essentially, well, it's just a very sophisticated linoleum cut.
Okay. Is that what you use, linoleum?
No, I use wood, ingrained boxwood, or in this case it's ingrained maple. Extremely hard wood. The wood has to be enormously hard. Leonard Baskin.
A frame of some kind in order to work with it?
No, it's made. There are block makers that make wood engraving blocks. It takes about 8 years to make a block. The best ones are made in Great Britain. There are very few good ones made in America. There was a man in Long Island City that was making them years ago, but he no longer makes them. He just quit making the blocks. And that's a major problem. That's why one of the reasons why this book is so small, because I can't find suitable wood that's of large size. It's in grain. That is to say that if you were to cut a tree in its rounds into pancake shapes all the way across and then cut into the end of that rather than putting a tree through a saw and cutting out planks. So that the tool which is an engraving tool and not a cutting tool, which is to say that it's a closed grain, closed ended tool instead of an open ended tool, it has no sense of direction. It can cut left, right, up, down, doesn't matter. It has no sense of being influenced by the wood. That's why these things are so bloody refined.
Are these the same size?
Those are the same size, yeah.
But, of course, with photography, they can be blown up.
With photography, they can be made larger and be brought down, or they can be made smaller and brought up. I'm somewhat unique in the field in that I always work 100%, never larger. And occasionally, even with media like watercolor, I sometimes work smaller and have it blown up. That's taking a lot of chances, though, because when you do that, you show all your warts.
Well, when you finish the illustration, then it's inked. Is that correct?
That's right. Then it's printed in a printing press, just like type. And, in fact, it can be printed alongside type.
Isn't it a case of having to work backward?
Sure. Yeah, when you look at that image of Edward Hyde's signature, and you can actually pick up some of the words in the document that Hyde's signature is on, all that has to be done backwards so that when it prints forward. Now, most people think that's strange. In my mind, how can you do that? Isn't that hard to do? And I suppose, yes, 25, 30 years ago when I first started making prints, it was hard to do that in. I know some of my early prints. We find this even in Dürer's engravings. You'll find where he will engrave the letter 4 correctly, except that when it prints, it's backwards. You know, and I've made a lot of mistakes like that. But today, lo, these many years later, it's so second nature, I don't even think about it.
Well, what happens if you do make a mistake? Is there any going back?
No. You simply have to invent around whatever area that you make, whatever mistake you make. The curious thing is the medium is so controlled, everything is so small, that the hand, unless the tool is real dull, and that's the, Eric Gill said one time, two things that make mistakes in wood engraving, a dull tool and a disturbed mind. Well, if the tool is dull, it will slip out of the line, and it can mar the surface of the block somewhere else. And if that happens, it's real hard to fix, and if indeed not impossible to fix.
Well,
so that it doesn't show up. So usually what I do is rethink the image and reinvent and so forth. And I don't mean that this is not self-aggrandizement, but I mean I don't make that many mistakes. The engraving itself is a craft. It's not an art. If there's any art in the book, it's in the whole book. It's not in the individual images, and it's not in the engraving process or any of that sort of thing. But art's different than craft, and engraving itself is a craft.
And an ancient craft. You wonder if you still do it.
Yeah. It was invented in the 1785, somewhere in there was the invention of wood engraving, but Thomas Bewick, and, well, he's given the credit for it, but in England, for precisely this work, to be able to print illustrations along with type.
Now, Barry, you also designed the book. How does one physically design a book?
Well, that I'm glad you bring that up, because it's the one thing that
I do that... 10 words or less.
No, I'll try to do it as quickly as I can and as efficiently. To me, the book itself, the process of the book is to design it, to specify the typography, to pace it, that is to figure out where the illustrations are going to come, the cadence of those, the illustrations, and then finally the illustrations themselves, the individual pictures. That's my hierarchy. That's in the level of importance. Because the first thing a person has to do is to read the book. And if I, as a designer or as a book artist, come in between the text and the reader, then I'm doing poor art. I'm doing bad art. Typography, again, to quote Eric Gill, typography is the art invisible. Good typography should never be seen unless you sit back and look at it in a very abstract way. In a very subtle ways, cause you as a reader to read the book, as a designer, to cause you to read the book slower or faster by what typeface I choose to use, by how much letting I put between the lines, what kind of word spacing I'm using, and all that sort of thing. You'll notice that this is a bold-faced type in this book. And it's not a typeface that was designed for book work in this way, for text work. Designed by Giovanni Martyrsteig, the arch typographer in Italy. It's called Dante Semibold. And it's done for putting things in bold letters at the beginning of a paragraph or what have you. But it's not designed for text. Therefore, there's no italic to accompany it. Fortunately, in this book, there are only about 5 or 6 words that are in italic. So we were able to get away with it by setting 10-point Dante. We set the italics, 11-point Dante, on a 10-point body, so that they align. Now, you might remember that this book was set in metal. This is not set in film. This is all real type, monotype. So that's my first responsibility, is to present the book to be read. And then the margins of any Moser design book you pick up, your fingers will never cover type. The margins are so generous that your thumbs never come into the text area. Something that always bothers me is when my hands cover up what I'm trying to read. And then the placement of folios. You'll notice in this book the folios only occur on the right-hand page and not on the left-hand page.
And I'd love to watch you set up a book.
Well, this is drawing board time pretty much, and I design at a drawing board with type specimens. Once I figure out what type I'm going to use, then I have sample pages set. And make further corrections on the specifications. And you know, it's things like commas, where commas come at the end of a line, where quotation marks, when paragraphs begin with quotation marks, how those things are treated and all that. And I spend so much time on that, which hopefully when you look at it, you don't see it. You know.
Well, by the way, some of those limiteds, you still have your Penny Royal.
Yes, yeah, Penny Royal Press is still right.
Mm-hmm.
Northampton, Massachusetts, yeah.
Northampton?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Barry Moser, it's a beautiful little book. It's a tiny little thing.
Most people think of it as a prayer book.
Yeah,
it feels like that.
You'd be very surprised. Can you get this at the regular bookstore?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
University Press book.
Yeah, but it's still at most bookstores. I've been all over the country now with this book, so it's around.
Sometimes university press books are difficult to get.
They are.
Commercial.
They are.
But this is available.
Yes, indeed.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you very much. Thank you.